Welcome to the Troubleshooters Podcast with me, your host, Mike McGrath. My guest today is a fascinating guy with a great story. Immigrant parents arrive from Europe after the war, told they can't have kids, and then, hey presto, along comes Richard. Richard is one of those entrepreneurs that got started early, really early. He turned his ability to get on with people and the fact that he liked going out at night into a business, and a very lucrative business. Richard then built one of the most successful construction and fit-out companies in Australia, specializing in nightclub lighting and audio visual. Richard eventually ran into some severe headwinds in the GFC when the bank decided they wanted to take their bat and ball home. Richard now helps other entrepreneurs through a fantastic initiative. He runs Coraggio, a business dedicated to putting business owners and leaders in touch with their peers for support to help them grow and prosper. So without further ado, let's get into it. Richard Skrzynski, welcome to the Troubleshooters Podcast with me, Mike McGrath. Now, we've known each other for a little while now, haven't we? Probably 5 or 6 years, or maybe longer.
5 or 6 years, yeah, absolutely. Okay.
So you are a lifelong entrepreneur with a fascinating story that we're going to get into. Anyone who's been in business for a while, by definition, has to become a troubleshooter. So let's go back to the beginning, if you don't mind. So you were the only child of immigrant parents, came to Australia from Poland at the end of the Second World War.
Yeah, with a surname like Skrzynski, it's probably about as Australian as you can get.
A little bit of a giveaway, that, but easier to say than spell.
It is indeed.
Not that easy to say even.
No, but mum and dad came to Australia in 1948, right after World War II. They came out of Poland, of the atrocities of World War II, and landed in Sydney. Mum was a nurse and dad was a truckie. Mum had obviously been a nurse through the war, but they were told through lots of advice from doctors that they'd never have children because of the atrocities of war.
Wow.
Dad sort of started up trucking, and mum started nursing at King George, which I think is just across the road from Royal Prince Alfred here in Camperdown in Sydney.
When did you come along then? So you were a surprise package effectively. They weren't expecting you and you arrive.
So my mum and dad were told they'd never have children. So my dad started building a business in trucking from 1948. Every year as it progressed, he'd sort of buy another truck and employ another driver. And there were lots of immigration at the time coming into Australia and people looking for work. And by 1960, he had quite a little bit of a trucking business going on in Sydney, Australia, and it was growing. And then my mum said to my dad, look, we'll never have children, so you're killing yourself growing this empire of trucks. In the end, my dad sold his trucks out completely and retired in 1960, and life was pretty good. And then unfortunately in 1961, through the miracles of modern medicine, I was born, and my dad regretted the day selling his business because he could feel the overdraft coming off on a family.
So Richard, was there anything in your upbringing that suggested that you were going to be an entrepreneur?
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting growing up as the son of a truckie. I think you learn hard work. It's a really interesting, I suppose, career being a truckie because, you know, the more miles you drive, the more money you make. And if you don't drive the miles, you don't make the money.
Yes.
I think those days, my dad was driving about 5,000 miles a week. That's how we made a living. And people sort of talk about, you know, the sacrifices of private business. And I think I learned at a very young age that the only way to make a dollar is through sacrifice or through hard work. It doesn't fall off trees. And now that I'm 60, I've learned since going into my first business at 23 that there is lots of sacrifice. There's lots of extra hours. There's lots of trade-offs between family time and private business that a lot of private owners make. It certainly doesn't fall out of trees. I think there is luck associated with it, and I think it's a case of the old saying, the harder you work, the luckier you get.
Yes.
I think I learned at a very young age that if you don't get in and make some sacrifices or take some calculated risks, and nothing's a given in private business, nobody teaches you how to run a private business. And I started being around private business when I was 16 or 17.
Tell us about that, because I said in the intro that you got started early, Richard. So you effectively turned a sort of, you know, what most of us consider to be a, you know, leisure time pursuit, going out at night, you turned it into a bit of a business and quite a lucrative little enterprise it was as well. Tell us a bit about what got you started.
Well, most ethnic children will remember the story that, and I'm certainly sure if you're Italian or Greek, our parents always wanted us to play the piano, accordion, or some fine instrument like that. My mum and dad certainly wanted me to play the piano, accordion, being Polish, and that was never going to happen in my household. And but I did take up the guitar, and for those of you in my era will remember that we never went to school discos. We went to school dances, and the school rock band played at St. Pat's. That's what we did. So I managed to play lead guitar, and I played guitar.
So you were lead guitarist in the school band?
Yeah, they were called the Chook Pistols.
The Chook Pistols. So that was probably quite a cool thing to be doing, wasn't it?
Well, it was very cool playing the lead guitar, and we had a lead singer and a, you know, pretty good rock and roll band playing at the school dances. And Strathfield was an area with a lot of schools, a lot of private schools. And if we were good enough, hopefully the girls turned up and liked the musicians. Yeah. So you just never know, Mike, you know. But, so but you don't make any money out of being a muso. And we all just happened to be at a party, I think around year 11, and the DJ at the time ended up getting, unfortunately, ill very early in the evening, and the girl that was having the party invited me to be the DJ. And I thought, wow, this is quite a good thing. You spin a few records and play a bit of music and your mates bring you over a couple of beers, and at the end of the night you get paid for it. And I was actually pretty happy about that. So one thing led to another, and I sort of, as I was going through year 11 and year 12 at St. Pat's, took up sort of DJing at all the schools in the area and doing a few parties. And I thought, well, this is a really good way to make a living, and as well as enjoying yourself. And then when finishing school, went on to uni. And while I was at uni, started playing in a few nightclubs. And
so when was this? Was this in the sort of 1980, was it?
1979.
Right? So, you know, what sort of music is
that? I mean, this is when you were still young, Mike.
Well, let's get back into, so we were talking about, in the UK anyway, we had the Sex Pistols in 79.
That's it.
We had punk rock. So,
that's
so
it.
What did you like at that point? We had Sting, the Police were big. I mean, anyone who's not as old as us, they will have no idea who we're about.
Yeah, well, when I was growing up, you know, the bands that were big were certainly Deep Purple and Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin.
Heavy metal. And did you like that sort of heavy metal?
So, yeah, Status Quo. I was a big fan of Status Quo.
Okay.
I thought they were pretty good. You know, these are all good bands out of the UK, so we're all pretty big fans. I thought they were great bands. Some of them came out of the US, but, you know, it was really good music. And,
yes.
You know, I think at that stage, their early 80s, a lot of the Australian bands were starting to come through as well, and live music was a big scene in Sydney and Melbourne.
Yeah. You were making money DJing and getting a cut of the door and doing okay, basically.
Yeah, well, what ended up happening is they used to pay a flat fee. I think it was $40 or $50 or $60 a night at that stage.
Mm.
But a couple of the owners of nightclubs around Sydney got a bit smarter and said, well, if you're worth your money, we'll give you a dollar a head for everybody we get. And if we get 300 people, then we'll give you $300. And if we get 500, we'll give you $500. So the harder you work, the harder you sweat, the more money you make.
Mm.
And the bands were on the same sort of thing. So a lot of these nightclub owners were pretty savvy. And they sort of put the same pressure on the DJs and said, well, righto, if you reckon you can get 1,000 people, then off you go. And if you get 1,000 people, we'll give you $1,000.
Yeah, okay.
Mind you, they took the rest, so they were doing a whole lot better than us.
Yeah. But, so what was a typical door fee back then this way?
$10.
$10, okay. So you might get a dollar. I would have taken a dollar if I was just...
So we're working pretty hard. We were taking home $1,000 a night, so which was a lot of money then.
So you got a bit of a taste of it. And then,
well, I got a bit of taste of entrepreneurialism, which is if you're good at your craft, big lesson in life, if you back yourself and you think you're good at your craft, then back yourself and have a go, you know. And if you're not, it would have been much easier just to stand back and say, well, you know, I'll just take the $50 and a flat fee. Or if you believe in yourself and you think you're going to give it a go and you're okay at your craft and you can deliver a good result, and then back yourself.
So you carried on with that, but you were telling me that you also got into banking after uni.
Yeah, well, when I finished my degree at the University of New South Wales, my mum, God bless her.
What did you do your degree in? Not DJing.
No, there was no degree in DJing. No, I did an economics degree and at the University of New South Wales.
How to take a cut at the door. Was that your major?
Yeah, it was. And but my mum, back then, ethnic mothers felt that good careers was being a doctor, a pilot, a dentist, a bank manager. They were all safe career moves.
It's all about getting a job, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was all about getting
a
stable job.
Stable job, safe job.
Yeah, that all the ethnic mothers could talk about on Sundays at Mass and at church to say, you know, that my son is a pilot or a doctor or a dentist. And I think it was pretty hard on first generation. I think there was a lot of pressure by our parents to And look, I think...
But you can understand that in a way.
Absolutely.
That, you know, that all that instability in a
second. Absolutely. I mean,
we forget that Second World War, that was 6 years of global chaos.
Correct.
And Poland in particular suffered. So you can understand immigrant parents saying, we want you to have a nice, safe job, Richie, enough of this DJing, taking a cut of the door.
So, yeah, so Mike, I my first job was at the ANZ Bank at 20 Martin Place and working under two really smart bankers, Cleve Lennon and Lloyd Guthrie, and which I learned a lot. They had a graduate program and I was privileged to be accepted into their graduate program. And I actually owe a lot to both of them. I think they were certainly two really good mentors, both very good bankers that lent on the strength of the person, not on the strength of the balance sheet.
Yeah.
And I often reflect that in life, when we shake hands with a person, it's the contract with the person, not with the balance sheet.
Yeah.
Good or bad. And I learned a lot from both of them.
And look, banking was very different back then, wasn't it? I mean, in that early 80s, the bank manager of the branch would have relationships and would make lending decisions based on those relationships and based on the idea and the concept and whatever it was that was going on. And it changed, in my experience, it changed in about 1990 when certainly in the UK, the banks had got their balance sheets in a big mess. They'd lent a lot of money overseas and they needed to straighten things up. And they did it by getting very aggressive with local lending. And, there was a credit squeeze at the time in 1990, if you remember, interest rates were sky high.
Yeah.
And I remember our bank manager at that point, Graham Kirby at Barclays Bank, visibly aged in the space of about 6 months. He kind of went white, his head did, because Region took over. He no longer was able to manage the bank as he used to and was having to report up to Region with his closing balances every night. And I think banking changed then. It got very remote, very analytical, as you said. You know, whereas we used to go and have lunch with the bank manager, you know, in the 80s, and you know, you could ring them up and say, I need another 50 grand. And you go, okay, Michael, no problem. And then it all changed.
Absolutely. And that was the year that I was, I think, at the bank for 2 or 3 years at the time and learned a lot about true bank managers lending on the strength and believing in people and people staying to their word and to their handshake. And, you know, they often say you need your bank not when things are going well, but when things are going not so well.
Yeah.
That's where you need the support of your bank. And I still today publicly say I think the ANZ is a great bank and they often have stepped in to support lots of businesses when things aren't going that well, you know. Look at COVID, you know, it's obviously affected a lot of businesses and not through any fault of their own.
The reality is that like any relationship, you get out what you put in and you've got to invest in that relationship and put them in the picture. We do that with all our clients. We encourage them to put the bank in the picture, you know, early on, tell them what's going on and articulate the situation. That's when I think you get support. You can't turn up having never spoken to them for 2 years and then say, you know, I need, you know, $100,000 by a week next Tuesday or otherwise.
On my payroll.
Yeah.
So I saw a lot of that at the ANZ Bank and I think we had some great businesses that were expanding and that's when we saw foreign currency loans. ANZ were a bit of a leader back then in foreign currency loans and mixed currency loans, which I think was pretty unique. And I think rightly or wrongly, they took a risk on all that, but we're certainly a leader and I think learnt a lot.
So you're at the bank, right? You're doing some, I presume you're still doing some of your gigs.
Well, yeah, I had one of these jobs where you work 9 to 5 Monday to Friday and then DJ after hours on Thursday, Friday, Saturday and Sunday nights.
Okay.
And front up for work on Monday morning, hopefully.
Not too worse for wear. Well, you used to go back to work for a rest, I presume.
Well, no, like I didn't go back to work for a rest. Please don't say that in front of the ANZ Bank. But anyway, look, yeah, I did and the business started to grow. And I actually went to the bank and said, look, I'm going to start a private business and I'd like to have a year off work. And they were particularly supportive.
Wow.
I remember both Clegg and Lloyd being very supportive of that. And I said, look, if it doesn't work out, then I'll always come back. But it was also the year my mother passed away of a heart attack. She was 60 and never smoked, never drank, but passed away.
And this was 85?
83. 83. And it was also the year that we started our business. Okay. And I always remember saying to my dad, look, we're going to start the business with $9,000. And if we blow the $9,000, then I'll go back to banking or I'll go back to, you know.
And what did he think of that, your dad?
Oh, he was very supportive.
Was he? Good.
Yeah, he was very supportive. He said, you've got to have a go. You've got to get it out of your system.
Right.
My dad wasn't a risk taker, but he was always a believer if you needed to have a go at something,
right,
then to have a go. You know, don't be one that said would have, should have, could have.
Yeah. So what was the idea? What was it that got you out of banking? Because I presume you had a pretty good career out of you, corporate banking.
Yeah, I was really enjoying banking, I have to say. And I suppose, Mike, the thing was that I love seeing people have a good time and enjoy themselves.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed the fact that music brought a lot of, I think, fun and happiness to people.
Mm.
Not too much, I suppose, which drives a lot of musicians today, as to what they see, people in entertainment. And I could see myself as the person that was the giver of that entertainment,
right,
and seeing people enjoy it.
So what was the business concept? When you nut it down to its essence, what was it you were going to be doing?
The plan was to provide two things. We really wanted to go and build and install and supply and design all the lighting, sound and video equipment that would go into a nightclub.
Okay.
And number two, provide the DJs to support those sorts of things. And though it might seem simple, there was quite a bit of a boom going on there in entertainment in Australia.
And that whole audio, visual audio lighting, that was emerging really. You were going from, the 50s and 60s with the sort of village hall type stuff, and all of a sudden things were getting a bit more sophisticated, weren't they?
Yeah, they were getting very sophisticated, I think.
Do we blame the Bee Gees for that?
Well, exactly right. Sydney had, private nightclubs, and it had, King's Cross.
Yeah.
Though we didn't build a lot of clubs in King's Cross, but, we had Oxford Street opening up. We had clubs opening up in registered clubs. We had nightclubs opening in big pubs like the Coogee Bay Hotel.
Yeah.
And, they all needed lighting and sound equipment.
Okay. And you guys knew what you were doing there. You knew what that should look like.
Well, look, we didn't come from a technology background, but we were happy to take advice and learn.
So the one-eyed man in the kingdom of the blind's in charge, right?
That's it. The blind leading the blind, But look, I think we were happy to have a go. And,
yes.
And there were lots of friends that were happy to jump in and install the equipment with us. And we knew some guys who were electricians. And look, and we made a few mistakes and we electrocuted ourselves a few times, I'm sure.
So the smoke was unintentional.
Absolutely, but you got to have a go,
And
if you get it right, it works. And if you don't, you blow yourself up. But look, it was fun and games and working pretty hard. We're putting in some big hours, and the dollar became 10 and the 10 became 100, and we never ran out of money. We kept going, and I always remember there were three of us that started it, and we were going okay.
So 89 then, 6 years on, there's two of you at that point. Give me some context. I mean, you were strong demand, you're fitting out all these places, interstate, and pretty big money as well. I mean,
yeah, the budgets were running high, and we're talking people spending, a couple of $100,000, $300,000, $400,000, which back in the 80s, which is big money.
Huge, yeah.
And then we started working for the five-star hotels, and we started working for the American chains. Bobby McGee's came to Australia. So there really wasn't an entertainment facility in Australia that wasn't coming here that we weren't working for or building for.
So you were really the fit-out guys in that late 80s.
We were certainly the go-to guys. We had one or two competitors, but that was it. And I think for the size of the market,
there was plenty of room for everyone.
Plenty of room for everybody.
So it was a niche, really.
Yeah.
The builders and the traditional fit-out hadn't cottoned on.
No. And look, once again, there was probably the third biggest lesson. You've sometimes got to be a bit of a niche creator and just see what the market was offering. And I see it today. Often what happens is sometimes it's the aggregator or the provision of all services that, picks up the whole pie. The pie was pretty segmented when we came into it.
Got
there was
it.
A whole host of, you sort of had to go to 12 different places to actually, buy different products that you needed for this sort of thing. And then all of a sudden it was very easy for the consumer to come to us and get, the complete package. So we actually made the purchasing decision very easy and could finance it all together for them. And that's where we actually then turned around. And I suppose you've got to learn sometimes how to finance different solutions. So we presented the same scenario and said, well, righto, apart from DJs getting a cut of the door, why don't we then say to you, look, we'll fit it all out, put all the equipment in, and if that brings a bigger audience, then we want a percentage of the door,
So how are you structuring that? Because that sounds pretty creative for that period. So you were perhaps covering some of your basic costs and then taking some upside for the margin.
I always remember building a facility in Gosford called Club Troppo.
That sounds very 80s.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've got to tell you, you know, I always remember the opening night there, and God bless the promoters behind it. I think two of the most successful and nicest people that I'd ever met. And I always remember that this was in the auditorium of Central Coast Leagues Club, and it was the opening night, and there was, you know, 3,000 people turned up, and, you know, you think they'll come to see INXS, and they'll come to the opening of Club Troppo, and they blocked off the main street and they had police and everything there, and Central Coast Leagues had a very big auditorium, and look, that place ran every Saturday night for, I don't know, the better part of 10 or 12 years, and I think in the end it got closed down because it was actually too successful and created too many problems at 3 o'clock in the morning when they tipped out 2,000 people onto the street. So it was a great success, and that was where you provided an entertainment place for people that were previously travelling from Gosford down to Sydney for entertainment, and all of a sudden it was there in Gosford, as it was in Newcastle. We built facilities in Newcastle and Wollongong and all over the state, and that was on a percentage type scenario. And if you're getting in 2,000 people at a dollar or two off the door, then you're doing that over 100 weeks or 50 weeks or over 10 years.
Fascinating. And so you carried on that, and then you were telling me another big boost was when it went visual, from audio and lighting to visual.
Well, I always remember the turning game. There was a point at which I think we were working on the what is today the Shangri-La Hotel, which back then was the A&A Hotel. And my business partner at the time, there were two of us, were successful in winning that project. And we ended up not just building their nightclub, but a lot of their function spaces and their meeting room spaces. And it was about the time that the word plasma screen appeared in our market.
Right.
And I always remember the senior management at Fujitsu saying that, you know, these 42-inch plasmas will sell for $15,000 to $20,000. And I can't believe, I could never have believed that the global market was going to spend $15,000 on what was a TV set at the end of the day. Yeah. I was completely wrong. And we saw people buying, you know, Pioneer 50-inch plasma screens for $10,000 and $12,000. And we obviously, being in the AV's commercial space, we saw the growth of the commercial market. Suddenly people were putting it into their boardrooms, their meeting rooms.
Yeah.
And that was driven by IT. You know, IT were coming in, people wanting to connect the computers to screens. The days of the three-gun barcode projector was over, and suddenly products like Sanyo. And I always remember the MD of Sanyo, Bill Crichton, saying to me, you know, projectors of the future, and you'll see a lot more, the price will fall. And as has been the case for the last 20 years, you know, Bill Crichton's always been right. And I think Bill, to his credit, was certainly a pioneer in this country. I remember him being the managing director at Sanyo, and Sanyo was certainly without doubt a market leader in this country in that space. And we saw lots of projectors go into school classrooms. We saw them go into hotels. We saw them go into boardrooms. So all of a sudden, our marketplace went from entertainment to overnight we were corporatized.
So it was a shift from fitting out disco and entertainment type venues to
working for the ANZ Bank, you know, and working for all the banks and all the accounting firms and all the law firms, and suddenly being involved in lots of facilities. And by that stage, it was getting to about the year 2000.
Yeah.
So we obviously saw the Olympics, and we were suddenly, you know, we saw the growth of facilities such as the Establishment. You know, we saw Justin Hems come into the market, and we were privileged to work for Justin Hems there. And we saw the Laundy family come into hospitality. We saw the growth of clubs. Registered clubs I'm talking about. We saw the entry of Crown Casino, Star City Casino, and lots of corporate offices. You know, suddenly it was collaborative meetings, it was presentations. All of a sudden people were bringing in their laptops, they were connecting to screens. And obviously an office layout changed overnight.
So you've been going about, what, 18 years at that point?
Up to 2000. Probably 2000 by then. You're 1983, so probably 17 years.
I mean, you were telling me that one of the challenges for you at that point was a sort of that credit squeeze brought on by the GFC affected you quite badly, and that you'd moved banks. You know, you followed the management, didn't you, I think?
We'd always been with the National Australia Bank for 25-odd years, and some of the banking relationships we had at the NAB then moved to the CBA, and as you do, you know, nothing's forever, and banking changed. But, you know, I think all the banks at the time, they just didn't have the money. Nobody had the money. They were saying, not just to us, but every Australian business, look, they just don't have the money to support the facilities. And suddenly we had suppliers saying to us, look, it's been great 25 years, but, you know, we're really keen to work with you, but it's COD. And it's like, well, it's pretty hard to run a payroll, pay everybody COD, and then want your suppliers to pay you COD when they want to pay you in 60 days, or clients, sorry,
it's,
to pay you.
It's interesting, Richard, you know, on that, the idea of sort of troubleshooters, right, is that periodically you get a correction.
Absolutely.
I mean, I left school in 80, unemployment 10%. You know, there's nobody that didn't know a couple of people who were unemployed, and it was seemed so difficult to get jobs, and, you know, it was just a downer time for 2 or 3 years. And then we boomed, and then 1990 comes along, and we've got interest rates at 15 or 16%, full-on credit squeeze. That goes for 2 or 3 years. And then 10 years later, we get the correction in 2000. Remember the tech bubble?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then the GFC. So, you know, if you wait around long enough, trouble's coming, right?
Yeah.
And Australia's been very lucky because it sort of avoided some of the impact of some of those recessions. You know, we've done relatively well in the GFC if you look on a global basis, but it's still, yeah, it was still a big problem. And I think that a lot of the younger entrepreneurs that I'm talking to and working with, you know, they don't always understand that cash is king, and that you've got to squirrel it away, and there are times when to push it and there are times when not to push it, really.
And the big learning curve, Mike, is like everything else, credit is a business, yeah. You know, and just because something's approved today doesn't mean it's approved tomorrow.
Yeah.
Whereas with cash at bank, there's no debate about cash at bank. And I have to say, certainly what we've seen in COVID and the businesses that have survived through COVID, apart from obviously the support of the government, the support of the banks, but the ones that have really survived through COVID are the ones that had cash at bank.
Yeah.
We often talk about how much cash do you need to trade through periods of that, but it's the ones that do have a strong cash balance. And if we take what is lesson number four, I think lesson number four is cash is key. Exactly, you said it. And it was interesting. I was listening to a presentation the other week by an industry body, and they were saying the best time to lend from a bank is actually when you don't need the money.
Yeah.
The bank seems to sniff and know when the times are tough and then you need the money, but there's a lesson learned there. So I think don't just assume, because the bank, like anything, rang us and said, look, I'm sorry, it's been a great relationship of 20 years or whatever it might be, but I'm sorry, you're going to have to cut the facilities, and they have every right to do so.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I have a lot of people that, you know, want to complain and moan about the bank, but the reality is the banks are not equity partners, right?
They're not.
They're there to make a clip.
Yeah.
And they're there to lend the money as long as it suits them, and they can withdraw those facilities.
Yeah.
So bring us up to date. Tell us what you're doing at Coraggio, which I think is a fantastic initiative.
So what ended up happening is I'd always wanted to give back and be around people and help people. And I think part of that is probably instilled by my mother, being a nurse.
Yeah.
And a colleague of mine, Mark Purbrick, reached out a couple of years ago, who I'd met through a networking breakfast, and suggested to me that I would consider being a chair in a product called Coraggio, which I'd never heard of. I never even knew such a thing even existed in this country. I learned that there was this organisation that had been created by 12 Australian shareholders about bringing private business owners together on a monthly basis to talk about, in a confidential way, and help each other with running a private business, which to me, I'd only wished I knew about when I was 23, not 48 or 49 or 50.
Yes.
And went and met some of the shareholders and some of the members. And I think at the time we had 46 members, and was really impressed by the values and why people had put me money on the table to support private business. And so luckily enough, things happened for a reason. I was appointed as chair of one of these boards, Coraggio Advisory Board number 2, which is now the second oldest board. They're all numbered, 1 to 100. The second oldest board in Coraggio, and the chair at the time was retiring, and John Mooney appointed me, and I became a chair. And I'd have to say that the first 12 months was a massive learning curve, and I think I learned more from the 12 Coraggio members than they certainly learned from me. And the following year, I was appointed to a second board, which was a Thursday board, CAP 15, which I still chair today. And then I remember when John Mooney rang me and said, look, I'm going to resign and step down. I've got 3 boys at Newington, and school fees are pretty expensive at Newington, and you might consider just babysit the role for us for 3 months while we find a new CEO. And I was actually really impressed by it. It actually excited me.
Right.
And I felt that this could go somewhere, and I wanted to meet the shareholders, and there's 12 of them. And so we put together a plan about scaling this business to 1,000 members. over Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne.
Wow.
And something that could really help a lot of Australian businesses. And so I think we've now been involved about 6 years, first couple of years as a chair and the last 3 or 4 years as a CEO. And I'd have to say today, as we climb towards nearly 500 members, and we have got boards in Sydney, Melbourne, Gold Coast and Brisbane, and a great sales team and marketing team and admin team and hardworking chairs that chair these boards.
Yeah.
And great members that have stuck with us.
So, Richard, just for the benefit of, you know, listeners that might not know too much about Carajo, essentially we're talking about boards of made up of the owners of individual private companies that meet every month.
Yeah.
Under a chairmanship of someone.
Correct.
To ostensibly help each other build and develop those companies and support each other.
Yeah.
Great.
And it's really interesting, Mike, and I don't come from a psychology background but I think there's a real turning point. You know, a lot of Australians have started their businesses from nothing. You know, very few of them have sort of come with, well, you know, here's 100 million, off you go. They've sort of scaled this thing through sacrifice. And then they sort of get to their late 40s, early 50s, and they realize they're not too far to 60, and what am I going to do with these things? You know, who's the partner that I need to work with to try and sell this business or get it ready for sale, or who would I sell it to? And those sort of advisors are not readily accessible. You know, like, you can't just sort of Google them or look them up in the yellow pages. You know, they just, they're actually hard to find. There's lots of people that put their hand up to say they can do that, but they don't.
Yes.
And it usually stems from some of the accounting firms. And look, there's probably some accounting firms that do it really well, but on the whole, these experts that work with you and to help you get your business to sell are not really available.
No.
And the thing that we saw were, there's this real age group there around 50, right along the eastern seaboard, that are really looking to sit with other owners that are maybe not getting the expertise from their accountants and lawyers and saying, what do I do with this thing? Do I scale it? Do I sell it?
Yeah.
Am I in there for a reason, a season or a lifetime? If I'm going to have succession, who do I talk to? Like, there's not just this panel of experts that I go to.
It's really tough, isn't it? I mean, you mentioned a couple of times that you started out in business at age 23.
Yeah.
And that was the age I started, ironically. But it's interesting. I had no help. You know, I was making up as I went along, a bit like you. But I would have really benefited. In fact, the couple of years after I started, we ended up selling 26% of the capital to a venture capitalist, a guy called Russell Smith. And then from that point, because we had to formalize, we had board meetings. And that was really the day that my business education began, because I had to start speaking to someone every month about what was going on and articulate what we were planning. And I started to get support and help. I mean, sometimes it was a bit painful because I was being challenged and told to shut up and that, you know, I didn't know what I was talking about. But that was really the beginning of my business education, was beginning to report an account every month. And ostensibly, that's really what's going on, because the other owners, I presume, at Carajo, you know, they've been in the tough school of hard knocks, haven't they?
Look, I have to tell you, Mike, I think in the last couple of years, as I've traveled pre-COVID, in all the locations, everyone has got a story.
Yeah, yeah.
And everyone's made some mistakes and everyone's not got it right. I've yet to meet somebody that's had 50 years of financial success and excellence in private business.
Yeah.
So I think lots of owners talk about mistakes and mistakes and mistakes.
Yeah.
I think a lot of them only make mistakes once, and they certainly learn from those.
Yeah.
But there's a real yearning for, you know, people are working really, really hard. And you often say to somebody, well, you have this $30 million business or this $50 million business, and when you get to 100, what are you going to do with it then? Or when you get from 20 to 30? Like, you get to that point and you know, are you going to sell it? Are you going to keep it?
Yes.
Or what are you going to do with it? And they don't really know. So there's all this energy going into scale, 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 grow. And then, well, when you get there, what's going to happen then? Nobody really has an answer.
No.
You know? So,
yes.
And I think Carajo brings that really to, you know, every month, to say, look, we know you're really busy. We know you're working really hard. But why? You know?
Well, I think the thing with an owner is you think you're meant to have all the answers, and everyone comes to you and says, you know, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? And actually, you don't, you know, but there's nothing like getting something out of your head and verbalizing it.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can't believe what you say. It's because it can often appear so great and lucid in your head, and then you start verbalizing it and you realize it's not as clever as you thought it was.
Well, yeah, if you've got a explain what you're thinking to 12 pretty smart people every month. Like, you know, and they're a pretty sobering environment, and you've got to sit there for a full day. And let me tell you, you're back there next month, So they're actually holding you accountable. Yeah. And to a large degree, a lot of owners, nobody holds them accountable, at all. They're sort of a, whether they have a great month or a lousy month or whatever it might be. But I've got to say, I think the ones that do take the step, and I often say, welcome to the dark side, because I think it's quite a step to step into a Carajo board and be vulnerable be raw and be honest and be accountable and share your numbers and your budgets and your forecasts and test your business plans. Then what I can say to you, I think the businesses are better, stronger, and people are happier. People are actually happier after they've spent a year in our boards, because I think they just feel just clearer on why they're doing what they're doing, you know, and because people are saying to them, well, why are you doing this? And often a lot of owners have been so busy over the last 20 years trying to pay their mortgage, trying to pay their school fees, run around after the kids, you know, try and be a great dad or a great mum, that they, you know, and run the business at the same time and employ people and get paid, that they've just been too busy borrowing for the last 20 years. All of a sudden they get to their 50s and they think, you know, it was sort of the other side of that. And we've paid all that off and they get a bit of free air and they start to have a good look at their businesses.
Now what? I know you love what you do, Richard. And, you know, I've been privileged to speak to many of the members, present to them from time to time. And there's a great energy around Carajo. And I think it's a great idea. I talk to people all the time about putting your hand up, you know, and getting some input and not being shy about that, really. You don't have to throw your brain away. You don't have to do everything that everybody tells you to do. But just getting some counsel from people who care about you, you've got to kind of earn the right to get that, to provide that counsel, I think. And I suppose that's what they're doing on the boards. Every month they turn up and help each other. Before we finish, I've got to ask you, so tell me your favourite place in the world.
My favourite place in the world would have to be New York.
Okay. Why is that?
I think the city's got a wonderful buzz. You know, it's just got a wonderful energy.
Right, yeah. And what about books or films? Anything stick out for you that's been memorable?
I've always enjoyed books written in Australia.
Right.
There's lots of books written globally, but I think the books that we see by Australian authors, especially business books, you know, it's not easy to scale a business in Australia. You know, we're only 26 million people. Yeah. There's only so much HR here. We're very entrepreneurial as a country, but, you know, there are things that are uniquely Australian. So I think anybody that can help us write about Australian business that's been there and done it, I think are invaluable. Mm. I think there are some great success stories. So I think any of the books that are written by Australian authors.
Yeah. And what about people who've influenced you or have kind of made a difference? Who would you give a shout out to?
I have a deep respect for my children. Growing up today is very different for them to how we grew up. Mm. You know, I think they're very social media. You know, they've got access to the whole world at their fingertips. It's very different to the way we grew up. Mm. And look, I think things like COVID can really affect our children and helping them get through that. They certainly have missed a lot of the fun years that we all had. Mm. You know, going through school or going through year 12 or going through uni.
Yeah, no, it's been tough, hasn't it? My daughter, Emma, my youngest, she was a late surprise package. But she has gone into year 7, first year of COVID.
Yeah.
Very traumatic that year at school, meeting everyone, then online, big uptick in the quality, you know, the quantity and the standard of the work being demanded. I mean, really, I saw her go from fairly carefree to pretty stressed in that year.
Yeah, and I think that's had an effect on our children. So I think anybody living in Victoria, I would have to say, I've only just been reflecting on that over the last couple of months.
Yes.
If we could bottle Victorian resilience in a bottle, we'd all make $1 million, you know, somebody that can handle that amount of lockdown and still come out the other side.
So just final question to you, Richard, and I'm so grateful that you've come in and shared your story, but what do you like doing for fun?
Spending time with the family is a pretty big priority. I think you don't have kids forever.
No.
You know, I think they come for 25 years of your life and then they go traveling the world. Well, I think this generation will anyway, so certainly enjoying them. Yeah, sport. I think Australia is a great sporting nation. I think we've got great water. We're lucky in Sydney, we've got great waterways. I love the water. And I think you've got to enjoy yourself and use that time, because before you know it, we could be at Rookwood. So, life, one thing, is not forever.
No.
So enjoy the days and look forward. You know,
yes.
I think we can spend our life looking backwards and with regret, but sometimes those days that are in front of us are probably going to be the best days of our lives. But, yeah, thank you for having me.
Richard, thank you. You are the entrepreneur's entrepreneur. What a great story. And I can see, I've only just noticed it, I can see one hell of a file of facts on this desk. That is a very 80s item, that. And you still got that as a cracker.
So, Mike, you'll be
the
happy
file
to know
of fact.
This comes from Daytimers in the UK.
Okay.
And I have been getting a diary from Daytimers every year for the last 30 years.
I'm going to put that up on our website. I'm going to take a picture of that and put that up on our website so that the millennials among us will know what a file of facts is.
Absolutely.
Richard, thanks for coming. Take care.
Thanks, Mike.
Bye. I hope you enjoyed my conversation today with Richard from Coraggio. If you like these podcasts, be sure to tell your friends and colleagues. If you want to know more about Coraggio, then the details are in the show notes. Finally, quick shout out to our sponsors, Oasis Partners. For great business advice, guidance and support, contact the team at Oasis. So until next time, stay safe.